Fishing the Intergalactic Stream by Louis Inglis Hall. There is a game and there is a player. That, I think, is the heart of it. Before that, before rocky pools and ocean floors, before mangroves that curve over warm waters, first we must define a fish. On the first world, this was easy. A fish was a category of being. It had gills and guts and cold blood. In the teeming, glimmering other worlds, it is much harder. The smiling, shambling waiter that served my morning bacalak has gills. I have guts inside of me. My editor has cold blood. Where do we draw the line? As fishers, where do we cast it? It falls to each of us to define the bounds of our particular ocean. High in the millennia trees of Pandendron Nunzig, skyfishers bait their colored kites and wait. On desert moons, caught in scorched orbit, the smoke harvest rumbles on each year. There are fish that crawl, and fish that climb, and fish that weave webs in the corner of a loved one's eye. There are microscopic bodies that endure the frost and suck a vacuum and are labeled interstellar krill. As for myself, I am a classicist. For me, fishing begins and ends with the water. Water is the leveler. Water makes things fair. There are two worlds. We each can breathe in one of them. I might have my trusty PD-890 Berserker series, true, but when the line is out, when the great game of tug is begun, either one of us might win. Either one might be exposed to a toxic domain. I have fought fish with fur and wings and wiles, but always, always in the water. So much for the game, then. So much for fishing. We turn now to the player. I am a veteran of every fishery world. I have wrestled kelp dragons on Hurus and untangled salt suckers from crystal netting on Caractacus sedum. Through this, I have gained some modicum of celebrity. There are distant places where I have seen my face on every screen, overlapping itself like scales. Multitude, cacophony. I am not built for city life. The game defines the player. In the vast black of space, the game is all I know. Who am I when shaped by diverse tides? On every world I fish, I am a different man. I descended into the gloom of a new world and thrilled at who I might become. Shreds of atmosphere rattled against the hull, a thin dose of rain. My capsule was thin-shelled, porcelain, equipped to rebuff any storm or eddy. Through its curving window, I watched as the dull and shadowed ball of rock slipped ever closer. A burst of ragged clouds signaled final approach. Twilight plains spread below me. This was Nero, unloved outer moon. Nero that maintained a distant orbit from its sister satellites and hid its graying face from any ray of sun. Nero, until recently designated blackout, now open for business. I left the window to fuss with papers and stack clothing and otherwise prepare myself. Some minutes later, my arrival was announced with a hiss like an opened drink. The capsule had landed itself quite calmly. A symphony of hydraulics followed as local air began to ventilate around the cabin. Night air, cool, with the tang of mulch of brittle leaves decaying down into fertile black possibility. From across the capsule, my penny made eyes at me and offered up a pleasingly sonorous set of subroutines. I dismissed them with a gesture. I had been assured of a competent gravity and hospitable terrain. Nothing further was required. To the experienced fisher, a penny is an invaluable asset. For regional dialect, long-distance navigation, even the correct order of cutlery, I rely on penny. They come as standard fitting within PD Pioneer-class capsules, and I carry a second model, localized to a hand strap for lakeside assistance. Today, however, my hand strap lay discarded on the far side of the room. I was embarking on an adventure and determined to meet it as I was, unaided, in canvas trousers, a cavalcade of pockets. This had been a blackout world, after all. Alone, I stepped out onto Neronian soil. Swamp rose up and sucked at my boots, vegetation tangled around in dense, murderous knots. The sweep of my torchbeam disclosed large, leafy foliage, a deep and solemn green. A thought grinned at me, refugee from some First World Western, Nero, population 1. Silence stood all around. The hushed glow of the torch had intruded on something. The land was holding its breath. I rooted myself to bog and earth, stilled my movement, turned off the torch. Slowly, they returned, those small and nighttime sounds. Something soft and squelching crawled its way across the toe of my boot and hauled itself away into the undergrowth. In the trees, a ponderous creak, as lithe forest bodies adjusted slumbering weight. Man-made dusk weighed heavy on the chill and lunar marshland. There was a click as I turned on the torch, a series of rustles to signify retreat. To the east and several miles ahead of me, The great house rose like a cliff face, white ghost, illuminated by lamplight. Its gabled roof rippled out into the night sky, origami folded into stone. They had laid it out for me, my destination, like a beacon. A path had been cleared, through wild and weed. I allowed it to lead me on. No fish remain on the first world, smashed cradle that it is. The other worlds, hub of trade and travel, offer only familiar delights. Their ecosystems have been traced over generations. Their seas have been catalogued and their museums filled. The denizens of these oceans are neatly pinned behind glass. I have played my own small part in this. Blackouts have become the venue of choice for the discerning fisher. These are the worlds of which the public know nothing, the unlabeled lakes and untrawled waterways where monsters still might lurk. Such novelties might drive a man to strange extremes. I had traveled to a silent moon in a distant constellation, a place where only corporations tread. Whole systems have been bought out, privatized. Redevelopment is slow, where it is cold and dark. Nero, its sister moons, its associated parent world, assets one and all, valued for their atmospheric shell, their capacity for life. Nevertheless, changes must be made. Jungles are conjured from lunar desolation, buildings and habitations seeded across the land. Glossy photos are prepared for brochures and magazines. I, as distinguished guest of the company, had been invited as the first. Soon this moon will swarm, this system will be absorbed into the great gestalt of the incorporated otherworlds. For today I was first fisher, pioneer. Nero, marble in the night sky, unmanned for so long. Soon it might outshine the vast and glittering planet below. The name of that planet is Pendragon V6, the sixth such acquisition of the Pendragon Corporation, and the name of the grand gray building that rose before me was, quite naturally, Pendragon House. There was a penny waiting, attendant, on the low wooden veranda as I approached. Unlike those I had callously marooned on the ship, this penny wore a female aspect. A procession of glow orbs had been tethered along the length of the house, bobbing fishbowls, brimming with a milky light. They raised long shadows along the grooved stonework, shadows that lapped up and down in steady waves. The house wore the orbs well. It became something marble and abstract under their baleful glow. As I came closer, I noticed that the curtains in every window had been pinned back, hard, with forensic care. Acres of plush, entirely empty rooms were visible through these vacant eyes. The gleaming, paranoid symmetry of it all was disrupted only by the unfurling of leaves, the overspill of vegetable matter. Nero's flora took dark bites, as if parts of the house had been redacted away altogether. I reached the threshold, and the suck of mud was a reluctant farewell. "Good evening," said Penny, in standard voice print 37, and hastened me inside. Within, the curve of dark wood ribs, upholding high ceilings, the gleam of alien stone, polished and practiced, layered into mosaic design. Copper, greening heaters that stretched languorously across the far walls like great lizards. A staircase rose and forked and dwindled away into shadow. I turned a corner, and on a painted stage, a troop of pennies whirled into life. They were a full and hearty orchestra. I stopped for some minutes to watch them play. Tuba was a recent patch, and I had been in deep space. In truth, interior worlds hold little appeal. I have been billeted in beach huts on pleasure planets and frigid bothies, where the wind whistles between every stone. I would rate them as very much the same. They gave me access to the water. Others will praise Pendragon House for its luscious pantries, its opalescent bed silks. For my purposes, it might as well have been a ruin, if only it retained its cellar. There were contained all the glories of the game, in neat rows, long-necked rods that reached across the aisles and formed wedding arches, netting and tackle and frost boots to walk across the waves, stim packs and pellet sharks and ice guns slotted into neat rounded holsters, a menagerie of lures, wings and tusks and beaks forming into variegated alien bodies. Heat shields and diving suits and warning bells, all neatly badged with the sinuous blue wyvern that stood for the Pendragon Corporation. I noted with approval the absence of scan tech. My inauguration of this moon would proceed manually. Penny watched with careful, machine eyes as I was swept around this temple of the craft. To her, each flay of muscle, each neuron spark was ably displayed. There is a known flaw in my kidneys. I believe I caught her staring. "Time to turn in?" she suggested, when it became clear that I would not leave the vast storehouse unprompted. Unwise, to go against the advice of a Pendragon personalized interface, especially one that is observing the motion of your vital organs. Not yet, I pleaded, in schoolboy timbre. Not until I had seen the water. It was late when we emerged from the cellar, and the sky was exactly the same. This was not especially surprising. The sky was always exactly the same. Pendragon House had been built on Nero's nocturnal hemisphere. To mitigate against the dark, a series of colossal glow orbs had been studded across the estate. Each blazed as a miniature sun, rampant with liquid fire. A muggy, chemical heat hung around them, and the nearby air twitched and sparked. The response from Nero's native flora, its quiet lichens and parasitic weeds, had been immediate. Surfeited on light and heat, they had gone into overdrive. Barren Nero bloomed with crimson flowers and lethal, snaring vines. Frosty plains were turned to lunar jungle. Summer had come at last to the dark side of the moon. Fish thrive in darkness. Their bodies are compromised by it, turned into weapons of necessity. Nero's black waters had once been sealed beneath a plug of ice. Now the deep sea started at the very surface. I had seen ice worlds corrupt into spectacular blooms of heat before. What survived that process was magnificent and strange beyond scale or shell. The deep breeds monsters, and monsters always stay alive. Nero's great crater of a lake lay before Pendragon House as a black and rippling horizon. Stars shone back from the mirror of it and formed inverted galaxies. The mud path of my arrival had led only to the back entrance. The lake had been concealed with stone and brick. Penny had now brought me to the front lobby. Here were housed many splendid and notable things. I paid attention to none of them. Through the windows, I could glimpse the water, and that was all. The walk to the lake was perhaps 2 minutes in length. I felt every slow second of it. All around me, an alien crop was coming in, thick, whippy stalks like so much forced rhubarb. I cut a path through and it rebounded, elastic, in my wake. Furred leaves brushed against the bottoms of my elbows. The shore was covered in dark and glossy pebbles. Thin lampposts had been fixed at intervals and gave monochrome light. The jetty stood like a woodcut, like a thing without depth or form. I climbed onto it without hesitation. I felt it all. The throb of cool, still water. The tension of life concealed. Below me, coiled creatures, yet unknown. Behind, Penny watched from the doorway of the great house. A thin wind had come to the Neronian night. I stood there in the half-dark and I basked in it. The game began anew. Satiated, I made my way to bed. An ancestor of mine once authored a paper book on first-world fishing. He spoke of rainbow-bellied fish and rivers folded into the slips of hills. He mapped narrow, winding creeks as if they were the bones of his fingers. It was confessional, a love affair with hard water that ran over chalk and flint. The fish he called trout and the river he called Truim, and both have since been bulldozed and wiped clean away. Little enough remains of the first world game. When we met the other worlds, we learned to play by their rules. One thing still endures from the time of fords and stone bridges and feathered flies. Sometimes we catch a fish and throw it back. I sat on the shore of Nero's Great Lake and allowed phantoms to play before my eyes. Old soldiers have a tendency to reminisce. The planet Ocean, plaything of the aesthete Callimachus Zen. A pleasure planet, clothed in one continuous swathe of salt ocean. For decades, its sole inhabitant lived in splendid isolation. Old Callimachus died in his 300th year, and the Zen literary estate had made its move. I have trekked from polar extremes to ocean's festive tropics, where floating hotels and low-orbit cocktail hubs crowd a simmering sea. I watch the passage of a brown, undecorated barge, the estate's lone concession to its namesake. Once Callimachus' unloved library, now it serves as museum and mausoleum in one. The rich and the beautiful commingle in the warm water, like dumplings in broth. I patrol them in my coracle. I keep to the edges of the carnival. At my feet, a bundle of PD-97 high-impact netting and a Pendragon Eliminator Series trident. There have been reports of liquid tigers lurking in the shallows. This is the day I prove the story's true. The planet Kappa Gamma Omicron, an old supply world mined hollow and left to rot. A black sea, impenetrable, roiled by fierce storm. I am a yellow plasticized speck on a Pendragon Class Cephid hunting rig. I lean over a painted metal railing. 100 feet below, the sea gnashes white teeth and beckons me into the churn. Rain falls sideways and tries to kick me overboard. overheard, a scream of metal as great girders realign, the flex of pistons, and a jolt as the steel spider of the rig resumes its steady crawl across the ocean. I return to the safety of the command node and my 6-strong crew. This is a vast planet, many times Nero's rather bijou circumference. Eyeless titans roam its shadowed ocean bed and are detectable only via long-range sonar. Our prey rounds on us, wraps one muscle strand around a lower support strut. We have it in our sights. I key in the sequence, and a corkscrew of supercooled liquid is injected down from the rig's base. A 40-foot icicle pierces the center of the monster's cerebellum to the sound of cheers. Old trophies failed to comfort me, as I sat for 4 days beside Nero's Great Lake and did not catch a single fish. I worked through the cellar in logical order. It emptied row by row. I laid the tools of my campaign on the jetty's boards. Each folded silently into the black depth and did not return. Daily, I prayed for minnows and was disappointed. On the first world, fishers were accustomed to failure. For them, it took a meditative quantity. They told themselves it was a different success. But then they sat with wooden rods and fished blind into waters they would never understand. I had utilized an arsenal. Such methods demand results. "There's nothing there," I complained to Penny at length. "I can assure you there is," she said, in a programmed voice that spoke only the truth. I did not like that I believed her. On the fifth day, I walked along the shore and kicked moodily at rocks. I had been selected as pioneer. I had been honored as first fisher. I had not expected it to be easy, true, my face on every screen, my failure transmitted across the other worlds. I could not leave this moon until I had succeeded. On the sixth day, I saw it, floating on the surface of the lake. I understood now why the curtains had been scraped with care away from window glass. We had reached the hours that Penny designated night, and I would not have had it any other way. Those who raised this house had known us fishers well. My room was sparse, reflective of my interests. Aside from the wide bed on which I lay, furniture was largely implicit. This was not a place where I would linger. Beyond the glass, Nero kept its regular twilight haze. Engineered light reflected from the surface of the Great Lake, projected onto the undecorated ceiling, I watched its waters ripple with ruthless consistency, utterly regular and undisturbed. I dared not look away for a moment. Ocean, Kappa Gamma Omicron, Caractacus Sedum, a haunting of old battlefields. Each world spun through my mind like pearls on a chain. They sparkled under cold suns, and the light on the ceiling had changed. I fell in a tangle of bedsheets and crashed my way to the window. At first, I thought it a kind of starfish, pale trunk and protruding limbs splayed all around. It seems bloated, silver with the lamp glow. It was only after some moments that I recognized it as a human body. I reached the shore in minutes, wild, half-dressed. Already, it was gone. Life began in the oceans. On the first world, it quickly diversified. It dragged itself to shore. It tumbled from cliffs. It dug into soft loam. Sapient life was land-based and grew hands and feet and technological devices. Whole systems drift silently by where early life peered up through a haze of slime and slunk its way back into the water to start an empire. The game played at its highest, fishing for intelligent life. On protected worlds such as these, I have been known to turn poacher. Camouflaged in Pendragon chameleonic waders, I flatten myself against the spire of some submarine cathedral, sniper in a city under sea. A stray toy in a child's bedroom proves an irresistible lure. Hooked and baited, the threat of it leads up to my vertiginous perch. After that, the squirming water baby serves to entrap the rest of the family unit. One such tableau from my trophy vault, a nest of squidlings caught in ice. The parents reach out with webbed hands. A pipe droops between the mother's lips. Aromatic sea smoke still spirals away. Some distance behind, a younger sibling protests, "Wait for me." Unfortunately, my flash freeze has preserved only one half of that specimen. His back end was lost during the extraction. I have baited homes and laid snares on office walkways. I have studied anglerfish and the pretty prize they dangle on a stalk. I understand when I am in a trap. A trail of snapped fibers and bruised stalks led between the house and lake. Sap leaked from wounded rhubarb stems. Penny followed this path with feigned interest. She had seen me carve it as I dragged a wooden chair from the dining suite. Penny saw everything on Nero that there was to see. "Are you quite comfortable?" she asked when she reached me on the shoreline. I am, I said, without looking at her. My eyes were focused on the taut black tension of the lake. Nothing from the cellar today? I am waiting, I said, as calmly as I could, to see if it does it again. Penny waited with me. My attention was on the water, and so she moved into lower resolution, freeing memory elsewhere. From the corner of my eye, I could see glitches run across the edges of her skin. We sat in silence until a timer announced another arbitrary night. The next day, we sat and did the same again. Days passed. My eyes honed themselves from scrutinizing black. Penny allowed herself to collapse into a mess of polygons. The body had been a lure. That much was plain. Only a madman would follow such a sign. Only a fool would follow the prize back to the angler's mouth in order to count its teeth. My mind returned to the city and the screens and the hot flush of first failure. I knocked my chair to the ground and stamped away to the house. When I returned, Penny was gone, and I held in my hands a pair of shrink-wrapped frost boots. Ice radiated out from my first step. It flickered through the water like an infection. The rough tread of my boot locked onto its perfect sheen. I took another step. Frost boots are a commonplace in domestic fisheries. In the wild, they are almost unheard of. I fixed my eye to the horizon and tried not to picture a soft wall of lip rising ahead of me as I strolled across an open gullet. Nero was wrong. The land was populous, the lake deserted. Surely this was not Pendragon's design. I passed a glow orb, nestled in the water as a marker buoy. Its heat crackled out and melted my trail behind me. Another lay 100 feet ahead. Another. I walked into the light and the center of the lake. The mortality rate on blackout worlds is expectedly high. I have spent my life playing the game. It is far too late to finish now. Too late when I saw the midnight glisten of the lure. Too late when I dimmed my torch and Nero reached for me with sticky, clutching fingers. My journal sits on crumpled bedsheets in the highest level of Pendragon House. In 12 hours, the auto-upload will commence, and the other worlds will know I met a fisher's end. There will be mourning. I shall be glad of missing that. I had spent some considerable time walking and pondering my imminent demise when I saw the island, no more than a boulder, in truth, jutting out from the cool infinity of water. The island was small, perhaps 5 feet from side to side. I stepped onto it with a nitrogen hiss. I reached down and deactivated the boots. The stone of it was brown and marbled. Geological straits of time, like layers in a cake. I took unnatural interest in this. My eyes slid from the impossible thing at the island's core and sought a logic they would understand. A sudden nausea, as the game I played changed rapidly underfoot. I felt along the uppermost flagstone and found it entirely real, entirely present. I was not mad then. It had the footprint of a first-world well, compacted gray stone, and a chute that dropped down and twisted away into nothing. A chasm at the island's heart, drilled deep and with precision. There was no water at its center. There were only tight stone steps, corkscrewing their way underground. There was no suggestion as to where the steps might lead. My torchlight revealed only the grayness of lower coils. Nero had laid me many paths. This had the flavor of the last of them. When only my head remained above ground, I turned and looked back in the direction I had come. The lights of Pendragon House were all extinguished. It had been reclaimed by Nero's hungry night. Down I walked, down still, encased in stone, barely able to extend my arms. The walls had constricted around me. My breath came out in clouds. The torch beam revealed the next twist of stairs and no more. The air grew cooler with each new step. I wondered how long I might walk before this changed, before the stone glowed red hot and I arrived at Nero's molten core. Eventually, suddenly, the stairs were at an end. I was deposited in an alcove, almost a chimney. There was only one way forward. I stepped out into a shock of light. It was a kind of coliseum. The lower walls were paneled wood, the floor polished stone, the mosaic design I recognized, the blue coils of the Pendragon Wyvern, the sapphire scales, a windowed dome, far above, reinforced against the weight of water, steel stitched through it, and lights shining up at the empty, sterile waters of the lake. In the center of the room was a table, lacquered and reflective. Baskets of fruit had been set along it at intervals. Around the table sat a cluster of figures. Each was clothed in the most immaculate suit. "Welcome," said one of the figures, "to the boardroom. We are terribly glad you could make it. The chair of the Pendragon Board of Directors indicated that I should take a seat. There's nothing there, I said at last, in order to have said something. I pointed upwards. In the lake. That's right, said the chair, as someone poured me a steaming bacalach. No native marine life at all, and we think you are just the man to fix that. Did you like the lure? Asked a younger fellow, jostling at the table with his companion. Of course he liked the lure, his friend elbowed him. He came down, didn't he? I don't do collaborations, I said weakly. You will, said the chair. You've played our game. It had you, hook, line, sinker, and this is just one of the worlds we've been working on. They all need fish, apex predators, bottom feeders, the whole lot. We just love your broadcasts, said a woman sitting to the chair's left. We play them on every screen. I had to admit that made a lot of sense. There is a game and a player. The game is designed by nature. It is a maze of dead ends and fossil records and carcinization. The fisheries of the other worlds have run dry. The catalogs are all filled up. Before that, before oil-slicked lagoons and evaporated streams, before hunting for tadpoles or bones picked well clean, first allow me to redefine a fish. I can promise you spikes and spines and armor. I can promise you teeth and tentacles and suckers and stings and vicious, sapient intelligence, creatures born from myth and designed by a master craftsman. I am a veteran of every fishing world. Now the game falls under my design. Pendragon's blackout worlds have been swept clean. They have been offered up as canvas. I have begun my work. Already, this crater of a lake throngs with new life. Sitting now, writing at the boardroom table, I watch my children swoop overhead. They have been tailored, gene-tweaked, made perfect. The great cellar of Pendragon House has been restocked. The game begins anew. Nero, flagship moon of Pendragon's newest enterprise, is now open for bookings. Louis Inglis Hall. Louis Inglis Hall is a civil servant living in Scotland. His fiction has appeared in Strange Horizons, Andromeda Spaceways magazine, and Apparition Lit, amongst others. He really did have a first-world ancestor who wrote a paper book about trout fishing in the Truam, John Inglis Hall's Fishing a Highland Stream, published in 1960.